brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm curator Chris Garcia. Seymour Cray is often referred to as the father of supercomputing. His revolutionary work at Control Data Corporation and Cray Research led to some of the most innovative designs in the history of high-performance computing. Here in his 1988 talk, What's All This About Gallium Arsenide?, Cray discusses his early work in supercomputing, as well as the use of gallium arsenide in his Cray 3 and Cray 4 supercomputers.
My primary mission today is to tell you everything I know about building a computer out of gallium arsenide. Now, that won't take all the allotted time because I don't know that much. So I thought you might enjoy a 10-minute history of our business as I remember it. For me, it began on the street in front of University of Minnesota in the spring of 1951. I'd run out of money, needed a job. It wasn't my money, it was the government's money, because I went to school on a program for World War II veterans, and you just have so much and then you have to quit. So there I was, didn't have much idea where I was going to go for a job. Actually, college recruitment at that time was not the advanced technology it is today. You had to find your own job. I thought I had good grades, but I had no job offer. So one of my instructors passed me and he said, "You found a job." And I said, "No, I don't really know where to look." So he said, "Try the old glider factory in St. Paul." And I thought that was kind of strange, but since I didn't have any place else to look, I found the old glider factory. Well, what I didn't realize then was there were two groups in the United States attempting to build general purpose computers. One of them was on the East Coast with Eckerd and Mauchly. It was called UNIVAC, Universal Automatic Computer. Jay Presper was never really modest, and I thought he probably thought of that name. The other group was in St. Paul working in the glider factory, and this was John Parker and Bill Norris. Bill had just got out of the Navy, and he was trying to make a living on cost plus fixed fee work for the Navy. That's a hard road, as we all know, and it was then too, but they seemed to be doing all right, and they had about 100 people there. So I took a job. Well, I worked for about a week not knowing what I was doing, as many of you probably remember, and then it occurred to me, none of these people know what they're doing either. I had read all the books in the library, which wasn't much, and I realized in talking to the other people that the blind were leading the blind, and I was as good as anyone. So I got my first assignment. The Navy assigned the work there by tasks. And the task I was assigned to was Task 13. Well, Task 13 was attempting to build a machine which was really quite a general purpose machine. And my job was to build pulse transformers. Well, that doesn't sound very impressive, but if you, any of you have read, I don't expect you to remember, Vacuum Tube Era, there's a problem with electrons going through vacuums. You have to have a high voltage to get them there, and so you have to have a transformer to get the pulses back down to the grids of the next vacuum tubes. And so this was a critical element I was assigned to straight out of school. Well, I felt uniquely capable of doing this job because I had two powerful tools. First of all, when I studied applied mathematics at the University of Minnesota, the last course I took was in Laplace transforms, and I figured I could solve most any technical problem with Laplace transforms. The other tool I had was a circular slide rule. Now, I had the 10-inch model. Now, that's as big as circular slide rules were made. So I had the very top of the line in computing capability. Now, many of you are probably not familiar with slide rules. But I can tell you, if you had a circular one, you had some social problems in college. The reason was that almost everyone else had a straight stick slide rule. And they came in a nice leather case, almost always orange. And they had loops on the back so you could hang them on your belt. Those minorities of us that had circular slide rules, of course, couldn't hang them on our belts. So as you walked around the campus, people looked at you kind of funny in the engineering campus, and they thought, of course, you suppose he's really not an engineer. But here came the payoff, I thought, because I knew I had this powerful computing tool and a way to solve the problem, so I went right to work. And I made reams and reams of calculations for my pulse transformers. And sure enough, the Laplace transforms worked. I built a prototype. It worked, and Task 13 went into production with my pulse transformers. So I felt quite smug. And then one day, when I felt I was caught up in my work, I decided to take a walk down the glider factory and see what else was going on. Now, this was a big building. It was 2 blocks long, 1 block wide, and 30 feet tall. It's a little story about that I should mention, too. Why in the world is a glider factory in St. Paul? Well, this was left over from the government in World War II, and it had to do with landing in France on D-Day. They glued together a bunch of wooden gliders, and they hung them together with ropes, and they pulled them over the channel with one airplane. There was an airplane shortage in those days. And so the idea was, after you pulled them over the channel, you could cut them all loose and they'd float down in France. And they actually were used at D-Day, but in a very minor way. But that was why the glider factory was there. Anyway, I digress. Walked down the glider factory, and I found at the other end of the line that by now Navy projects were up in the 20s, because things moved fast in those days. This was just months later. And I found a much older engineer, and I asked him what he was doing. And lo and behold, he was making pulse transformers too. And I told him about how I made pulse transformers using Laplace transformers and my big 10-inch circular slide rule. And he smiled and he said, "I know about Laplace transformers, and I know about circular slide rules, but I don't use either one of those." He says, "I use intuition." And I thought, wow, here's something new. He said, I've been doing this so long, I can pretty much guess how to do it. And so I just make a few this side and that side of what I think is optimum, and I try them, and it goes much faster than doing all that calculating. And so I put away my circular slide rule, and after that I used intuition. So that was my very first lesson. Well, the Navy tasks moved on. Didn't take long. A year later, I was on another project. We began to worry about commercial applications. Well, had to have another name, couldn't use Task 13 because that belonged to Navy. So we converted it to binary, called it the 1101. And that's how the 1100 series got started. After that, we decided we'd just keep on going through 1102, 1103, etc. By the time we got to 1103, a year had gone by, and I was the project leader. I mean, the promotions were fast in those days. And so had technology. Just to remind you, Eckert and Mauchly were building computers with vacuum tubes, of course, because that's all there was for logic. But they were using mercury delay lines for their fast memory. You know, transducer at one end, transducer at the other, and hook them together, and every time it comes around, you can change it. Well, that wasn't really random access. And we felt so much smarter in St. Paul because we had Williams storage tubes, And they really were random access because you could address each bit on the surface of the cathode ray screen. So what I'm doing here is preparing you for gallium arsenide. I hope you understand this. But as we went along to 1103, there were gigantic steps forward in technology, particularly in memory, because the Williams storage tube had 1,024 words. That was very big, but people thought they needed an even bigger memory. And so for the 1103, we had new technology, magnetic core memory, and we had a huge memory, 4,096 words. So that was the beginning of serious computing in the sense that people began to think of this as perhaps a commercial machine. And so it began a marketing effort. Well, that caught the attention of a typewriter company called Remington Rand. And Remington Rand bought both Eckerd Mauchly and Engineering Research Associates in St. Paul and made this big conglomerate. And things began moving even faster. We got more and more contracts. The Air Force had a contract. Navy had contracts. Pretty soon, we had all the business we could handle. Just to make the story a little short, there was one interesting phase before moving on to transistors, and that was magnetic circuitry. This was a very interesting phase, but didn't last long. After vacuum tubes, there was a period in which the square hysteresis characteristics of molypermoly offered an opportunity to make high-speed digital circuits without using so many vacuum tubes. You still needed a few to make big power pulses, but then the power pulses went through these networks of magnetic circuits, and you got the gain from the square hysteresis characteristic of the metal. A wonderful product of the steel mills of the United States. Well, one of the things I'm most proud of is a patent I got at that point in time. Those of you who are familiar with patents should appreciate this. I got a patent for a parallel magnetic circuitry. And the thing I'm proud of is what the patent examiner wrote on it. This was hard to believe then. It's even harder to believe now. He said there was no prior art. Fantastic. I'll always keep that patent. Anyway, it only lasted a couple of years. There's a few products delivered to the Navy, and then the transistor came along. Now, they weren't the kind we have today. They were made out of germanium. They were called surface barrier toasted transistors. I never understood the toasted part, but it must have had something to do with process. Anyway, they were very fragile electrically. You just look at them crooked and they burned out. But they were faster than the magnetic circuitry, and so I had to believe it was the wave of the future. Well, I went through a number of other projects there, including one called the Naval Tactical Data System, which was a monstrous project by any standards at that time for taking all the inputs for ships and the fleet and converting everything to digital form and displaying it. And it was a very successful program, but the company was getting too big for me, so I decided it was time to move on. So did Bill Norris, because he was having trouble with Remington Rand management. So we started a new company called Control Data. Well, there were about four of us that were involved initially in getting that started. One of them was Bill Drake, and I have to digress here a little bit to tell you about the blue sky laws at that time. There weren't any. And so Bill Drake parked his car about a block from the entrance to Engineering Research Associates, now Remington Rand, and he left the door open, and he had a clipboard. And as people went by, he'd say, "Psst, you want to buy some stock?" And the word got around, and a lot of people stopped in. I stopped in, too, and I gave them all the money I had, which was $5,000. And he raised $600,000, which was kind of unbelievable for open-door policy at that time. Anyway, that's the amount of money Control Data started with. So we got a little corner office in a warehouse in downtown Minneapolis, belonged to the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. Working conditions weren't good there because we had just an office for about 10 people and the rest of it was all open area. It was filled with newsprint. Well, newsprint came in monster rolls that weighed about 2 tons. And they were piled in one side, and I had this little lab on the other side. And I worked mostly at night, and there was this noise at night, because there were little wooden blocks under these big rolls, and they keep slipping. And you could hear this slipping noise, and you knew if any one of them let go, there'd this big roar, and they'd all roll across the room and smash me into the wall. So that was the problem at night. There was a problem during the day, too, because the propane trucks were running all the time, and you could hardly breathe in there. But anyway, that's how that company got started. There was one other interesting thing, too, economics. It really was a lesson to me, because I was the one to decide we should make computers. Everybody else thought we should go into point-of-contact sale machines for Dayton's and Donaldson's and department stores. I said, no, all I know how to do is make computers, so I'll do that. But I knew it had to be very, very cheap because we didn't have much money. So I went to the local store, which was sort of the Radio Shack of that time, and I said, what's your cheapest transistor? And they found me one made by General Transistor, cost 37 cents. And I thought, great, I'll take all you have. And I went back and I tried to make a circuit out of these things. And they were characteristics of just all over the place, no two alike. But never mind, I had to do it. So I made a circuit that was very, very tolerant. And it worked. Diode transistor logic, it was called. Well, went back and got some more. They kept stocking up, kept going back and getting more. And then one day, the economics came to me. A man appeared at the door. He was from General Transistor. He said, I'm sorry, but you can't have any more of those transistors. I thought he was going to say, now you can get a volume deal. He said, you can't have any more. Those are the fallouts from our line, and you've used them all. So now you're going to have to pay twice as much if you want to get any more. What a terrible revelation. But then it was too late, so he had to go ahead anyway, and I made a 1604 computer. Well, time went on, and there was a whole series of rapid evolutions in transistors. It was only about 2 or 3 years later, and the planar silicon transistor arrived on the scene. What a great invention. It didn't burn out as easy, faster. And so the 6600 got started. There was a whole evolution during the period of 1960s, where transistors moved along very rapidly, machines got faster and faster. Then something terrible happened. The serial speed of things stopped. And everybody promised me things would get faster, but they didn't. Years went by. Anyway, continued to make machines. Memories got bigger. Company got bigger. Got too big. So I had to leave and start again. I like to start over. Keep doing it. Did it just this year. Anyway, started Cray Research, and at that point in time, we concluded transistors just aren't going to get faster fast enough. We've got to think of something new. There was a vector machine being made called a Star, which I didn't do, but I thought, not a bad idea. Start a new company. Let's try that. And so we began vector computing initially at the beginning of Cray Research. Well, so that lasted for a little while. Lasted about 5 or 6 years. And we still weren't fast enough. Transistors weren't fast enough. And so we began talking about parallel machines and parallel vector machines. This is a real struggle, obviously, because what we're missing here is the serial speed you'd like to have. So I began to think about gallium arsenide in about 1979 or 80. It was the time of the Cray 2 development program. I thought, it's time for something new. I knew that gallium arsenide was being used in communications work, and they said they used it because it was faster than silicon. So I said, why can't we make computers out of this? Well, there was one company that was sort of interested in doing it. It was Rockwell, and they were doing some government work, digital gallium arsenide. Tried to make a deal with them, tried to get some circuits made, but after struggling for about a year, concluded it was premature. They just weren't ready to manufacture gallium arsenide circuits of the kind I needed. So I had to give up on that and made the Cray-2 computer out of silicon. And that was too bad because the effect of that was that the scalar performance of the Cray-2 didn't keep pace with the vector because of the relatively slow circuit speeds. So here comes the computer generation later. And I've been working for about 5 years now on the Cray-3 project. And here comes gallium arsenide for real.
From the archives of the Computer History Museum is drawn from the audio holdings of the Computer History Museum. It is produced by curator Christopher J. Garcia. Music is by John Plute. For more information on our other audio holdings, please visit computerhistory.org. Thanks for listening.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.